started in New Jersey. My grandfather liked telling me the story of how, when the two sides met, they had a party, and New York City had a big celebration. To me, Boston should be just as proud of the progress Larry Bird's nose and chin are making on their journey to become one. When they finally connect, the city of Boston should take at least a week or two off and celebrate with free shish kebabs for everyone, because that will be the only food Larry will be able to shove into his mouth through the side. They should also rename the MBTA's downtown bus loop Larry Bird Loop in his honor. It will be like Boston's Bastille Day, with a film adaptation starring Mark Wahlberg. I'd like to point out that none of this is as terrifying as Dennis Johnson, a red-haired African-American with freckles. Casey Jones' coach. His name explains Bill Walton's dedication to the team. In Bill's mind, Coach was driving that train high on cocaine. Casey was a former player who turned into a chubby, conservative-looking guy after retirement. Looking at the picture included with this program, he resembles none other than Tracy Morgan after his car accident. I love Tracy, and I don't feel bad about making that joke because, God bless him, Tracy is living like a lottery winner. I recently saw a picture of him in the paper standing outside of the $14 million house he'd just bought. I'm guessing that he got about $100 million in settlement money based on the fact that Artie Fuqua, who was in the accident as well, was still broke before that Walmart money rolled in. Tracy had money, but Artie was still living in the ghetto at 48 years old. Now he's got a fire engine red Cadillac Escalade, a huge Range Rover, and wears a different Brooks Brothers blazer on stage every night. He was on a bill with me recently, so I did this joke. I hear Tracy Morgan pays $25 million to open for him. It killed. Danny Ainge, guard. I know what a lot of you guys are saying. Maybe you're Celtics fans or maybe not, but I hear you saying, Art, you're wrong. Not all the 86 Celtics were ugly. Danny Ainge was good-looking. My answer to you is, stop reading this immediately, return to the store, and exchange it for Aziz Ansari's book, you fruit. As far as my larger argument regarding the supreme ugliness of the 1986 Boston Celtics, you can say, Art, you're right. If you are sensible and logical, that's what you'll do. You'll say, Art, you're right. The more cynical among you may feel that I'm miscalculating, and some of you may even claim that there are uglier teams. For example, the 1975 Cincinnati Reds, featuring such male models as Pete Rose, Joe Morgan, who was a very odd-looking guy, and Dave Concepcion. You are welcome to your opinion, but I don't agree with you at all. On a side note, I once had sex with a stripper that looked like Pete Rose. I met her at a club called Lace in Nyack, New York, after a gig at a nearby comedy club. We really hit it off, so she came to see me do a set at Caroline's in the city, and afterward I talked her back to my place in Hoboken. This was when my ex-fiancé, Adrian, and I were on a break because we'd been fighting so much that she moved out. Anyway, this stripper was Russian and knew nothing about Pete Rose or baseball, so I was able to call her his nickname, Charlie Hustle, without her knowing what I was talking about. Charlie Hustle, get in here! She thought it was a cute nickname I'd made up just for her. She and I broke my bed, by the way. She was very athletic, sexually. She really knew how to slide into home, but it wasn't her fault. I'm fat, so the thing just fell to the floor while I was humping her. For the record, during sex, I got her to admit that she'd gambled on baseball while employed as a manager. The lesson here is that the 1986 Boston Celtics cost me, at the age of 19, $16,250. As I mentioned, I was into drinking and drugs, and mixing those with gambling is a lot of fun, but it typically has disastrous side effects. Here's an example. The under-over in a Boston-New York basketball game was usually about 190 points back then. The odds in baseball are usually minus 200. One time that year, my bookie Bobo took advantage of how drunk I was when I called him. He let me place my bet on a baseball game as if it were a basketball game. Making bets in a blackout is never a good idea. The next day I asked him, "Why would you think that? No baseball game in history has ever had 190 runs. I did it because you need to be taught a lesson, he said. Thanks, Mr. Bookie, I said. Have I just earned my degree from Gambling University? OTB. OTB, which opened in 1971 in an effort to funnel the profits that bookies made on horse racing back into the city, closed in 2010. So you'll have to take my word for it when I tell you what those places were like. There were 50 of them in Manhattan and the outer boroughs, and I used to frequent the one on 7th Avenue and 38th Street when I was driving a cab. Usually I'd stop in during off hours, in the middle of the day. It was the type of place every student of anthropology should have seen, because it was chock full of humans that you didn't see anywhere else. It was like a Starbucks for insanely degenerate gamblers who were too lazy to go to racetracks like Aqueduct or Belmont, where, by the way, they have lunch specials several days a week. Not even the promise of $2 plates of chicken could tempt these specimens to leave their dingy off-track cave. Those lunches, which I have seen with my own eyes, were also worthy of study by scientists because for $2, you could get chicken sitting under fluorescent lights so harsh that you were able to see the veins and the connective tissue, and if you looked closely, you could trace the entire life cycle of the chicken. It was like those chickens were starring in the Albert Brooks film Defending Your Life, in which the main character stands trial in the afterlife, justifying his fears and decisions in order to progress to the great beyond. Looking down on those once living things, I could see it all. The chicken born, tortured, killed, cooked, and left to be examined by losers like me. Anyway, the daytime crowds at OTB were fascinating. I have no idea how they became who they were, because it clearly didn't happen overnight. If I were forced to recreate one in a lab, here's what I'd do. I'd go to a White Castle in East Orange, New Jersey at 4 a.m. and find, as Jimmy the Greek would say, the biggest buck. Then I'd go to the grimiest DMV in the city and look for the crowd of people who go there just to hang out and talk. Believe me, those people exist because I've met them. Next time you're forced to go into one of those hell holes of bureaucracy, look around and you'll see them in the waiting area, waiting to talk to you. They don't have a number and aren't concerned about the line, and they usually have a big gulp and a lot of questions and elastic waist pants. Anyway, I go to a dirty DMV and find the biggest woman in that group and mate her with the biggest buck I'd poached from White Castle. Then I'd wait until their offspring was of age and mate it with the entire upper deck at the Philadelphia Eagles home game. I'd wait again, and when that child was born, I'd take it and raise it in a barn and never teach it hygiene. After about 24 years, I'd do the humane thing and set it free in an OTB during the day where it would feel right at home. Another way to replicate an OTB regular would be to go to a Fish concert, where, by the way, Bill Walton would fit right in, and find a kid who has been doing nothing but following them for about 15 years. He would need to be about 38 years old and to have spent the better part of his life shitting in porta-johns. I say he because women were there, but they were few and far between at OTB. Now, as filthy, shifty, and disgusting as these people were, they had something in common. They were all good at handicapping races. They analyzed horse stats round the clock and were great at assessing the lineup and the handicaps and wagering their cash to make a few bucks. For most of them, it looked to be their full-time job. Back then, a kid I knew who worked in my hometown bar and did some side work with a connected bookie used to give me tips. Sometimes on college games and sometimes on horses. When he did, I'd go to OTB to place my bet, and since I'm a people person, I'd ask a regular what he thought of the horse. Usually the guy wouldn't even look up from his racing paper. So what do you think of Daffy Darling in the sixth? I'd ask.
Piece of shit. Only there to round out the field.
Thanks. I appreciate that. And then Daffy Darling would win because if the kid had given me a tip on a horse, it was definitely a fix. Horse races are the easiest events to fix, and usually it happens a few ways. Crooked trainers and owners will give the horse a shot of something illegal to increase its stamina, or when they see a light field, one way or another, they'll make sure that the other horses aren't able to do their best. It's not hard to regulate, since there are only 5 horses in most races, so that's not a lot of competition to sabotage. They will literally stab another horse so that it can't perform at its peak, or stash its head in the bed of a movie producer who crossed the family. Ole Miss versus Air Force. The kid who gave me tips was right 100% of the time when it came to horses. When it came to sports, not so much. In 1992, Ole Miss and Air Force were in the Liberty Bowl, and the line was 9. The kid told me that he had inside information that Ole Miss was only going to score 13 points. That was a weird, very specific number, so I believed him. What that means is that if Ole Miss, the favorite to win, was given 9 points and only scored 13, they probably would not cover that 9-point spread. Even if Air Force sucked and had the worst day in the history of the team, all they had to do was score 1 touchdown for me to cover my point spread and win some money. This was a no-brainer bet. I can't remember how much I put down, but it was a lot, because this guy had given me foolproof tips at the track, so I trusted him. In the end, Ole Miss won 13-0. All I needed was 1 touchdown, and I didn't get it, so I was pissed. "What the fuck, man?" I asked him. "That tip was shit." "Hey, don't blame me," he said. "They did what I told you they would do. They scored 13 points." Clearly, my degree from Gambling U wasn't worth shit. Super Bowl 38, Carolina Panthers versus New England Patriots. This one has been discussed in the other books, but I bring it up again because I have details to add that make it a worthy entry into the Sports Hall of Shame. First of all, it's a famous Super Bowl because the over didn't look good, and also because Janet Jackson's pierced nipple fell out on national television. Both teams went scoreless in the first and third quarters, and by halftime the combined score was 24 points. Then Tom Brady did his thing in the fourth quarter because he can beat anyone in the second half with the exception of Eli Manning, which I find so odd. That is why I insist that there's something off about Tom Brady. He's blessed against every quarterback in the league except a mouth breather who looks like a mongoloid. That guy is his kryptonite? Really? Lucky for him, the Giants usually beat themselves most of the time. Anyway, that weekend I was booked to do 2 shows at the Mirage in Vegas at $60,000 per show. Plus, they gave me another $20,000 to host an after party at their stupid club, Jet. I was looking at a $140,000 weekend. It was going to be great. I was still dating Dana, who called me with an urgent message. She and her mother wanted to place bets on the Super Bowl. They wanted to bet the over-under. This was a first. "So how much do you want to bet?" I asked. "Okay, I've thought about it, and I want $50 on the over, and so does Mom." "Okay, I got it." I hung up, having no intention of placing that bet, because I would never bet $50 on anything. That's even less than just the tip in my book. Then I realized that Dana was all excited about this and was the type of person who would want to see the casino ticket from the sports betting room at the casino as if it were an invitation to a bachelorette party. So I went down to the sports booker in the hotel, placed their bets for $50 each, got the tickets, and called her back. "Okay, I did it. You're both in for $50. She was thrilled and very enthusiastic.
"Oh, this is so fun. Well, let's root for you too. What do you have in?"
"I have $20,000 on the under," I said. "Good luck." The game will go down in history as one of the most well-played and thrilling games in Super Bowl history. The over won, of course, so I lost my $20,000. The only upside was that someone at a Jet game got me a whore who I fucked with my socks on. She blew me in the bathroom,
and was so sexy that I asked the guy if she could come back to my room. He made that happen, so when I was allowed to leave, she came with me, and I fucked her, and I have never felt like more of a loser while fucking one of the sexiest girls I've ever seen. She redefined the word stoic. Have you seen the Clint Eastwood film Sudden Impact? Sandra Locke's character gets gang-raped, and she sits there catatonic as it's happening. And this girl's expression was a dead ringer. Actually, that combined with the look on the dead horse's face in The Godfather. "I must have been really good," I said to her afterward.
"Why do you say that?"
"Because you put the magazine down for a minute." The only time I saw emotion flicker across her face was when I went to get her some money. At first, she stopped me.
"You don't need to pay me. I'm taken care of," she said.
"Let me just get you some money, I insist." As I walked over to the safe, she covered her mouth and started giggling.
"What?
What's so funny?"
"Your socks," she said, barely getting the words out. "You kept your socks on."
She was young and already soulless, God bless her. She had not one shred of innocence or humanity left. Then she sold me some ecstasy and left. It was quite the weekend, which, by anyone's standards, would look to be a winner. Anyone but me, that is. I took in $140,000, but after gambling, whores, drugs, food, strippers, who didn't tell me they were whores until they were in my room, more whores, and Dana and her mother's winnings, which I forgot to pick up and had to pay out of my own money, I ended up down $5,000. Dana was so excited to have won her bet that she asked for it right away. And you can't imagine how hard it was for me to fork that over. I would have rather given her teeth from my own head, pulled out with a pair of pliers. The only thing worse than adding up my losses on the plane home was walking into my accountant's office. He was sitting there behind his desk expecting a check for $140,000. "Great game, wasn't it, Art? And you really cleaned up out there. I'm going to take the taxes out now and..." "Yeah, about that," I said. "Change of plan. I need a check for $5,000. Chapter 13. Now everything's happened. Everyone loves stories of winning big at the tables, of the impossible craps run, of hitting 10-to-1 odds on a game or a horse. It's the lotto, it's the American dream. It's the golden ticket and the oasis we all want to believe exists in this desert we call life. It's the snake oil that keeps people going, because human beings need to believe in something. The thing most people don't talk about when it comes to gambling is the losing. Unless you're addicted to thrills and allergic to boredom like I am, losing is the embarrassment you sweep under the rug. Organized gambling, legal and otherwise, is a losing proposition for the gambler, so unless you accept that, you're kidding yourself. I embrace it, and I enjoy it, because I get the same jolt of adrenaline when I lose as I do when I win. That's because when I lose big. My losses are like a huge ship passing by, trailing a wake of chaos, and there I am, having the time of my life, just an asshole on a jet ski catching air off the backwash. I will forever be bitter about certain losses and certain teams and players who have cost me tens of thousands of dollars over the years, but I don't begrudge the excitement. Since I'm lucky enough that I've been able to keep earning money, I don't think I'd trade the memories for my cash bag. Naturally, when it comes to betting with my life, I apply the same philosophy. Unfortunately for me, the game I lose biggest at is the one I can't stop playing, and that game is a roulette called drugs. I just can't stay away from them, and it's not cool or something I'm proud of. I'm an addict, and I do my best to stay sober and keep from letting opiates and cocaine destroy all the good things I have going for me, but it ain't easy, man. Drugs are a surefire way to dial up the unknown, because, much like the way I bet, when I do drugs, I go big.
About a year ago, I fell off the wagon after a year of being completely clean. I went on a 2-week bender that couldn't have come at a worse time. I was arrested because the cops caught me with a lot of heroin and cocaine, and because of that, I ended up under indictment. I went to court over that incident and put it behind me, but then, in early 2017, I fucked up again and got arrested for possession once more, this time sitting in my car in the basement garage of my condo. Luckily, Hoboken is an old-school kind of town, so I was able to make some calls and pull in some favors and manage to get my charges reduced so that I didn't do hard time. Anyway, let's go back to that first slip-up, because drug stories and gambling stories are both studies in risk, which is what I'm trying to make sense of here. Remember a few chapters back when I admitted to cheating on Dana with Vegas strippers 11 times in a week? Well, there's more to that, because it wasn't a one-time thing. It wasn't a case of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. It was a case of what happens every time I leave town stays in whatever town I go to. Vegas was extraordinary in terms of the quality of the women available to me, but when I was on Stern and doing stand-up on the weekends, there was a chick waiting for me in every city because it was just so fucking easy. I could never talk about it on the air because I was with Dana, but now, fuck it. I don't care what she knows or thinks of me anymore. She has a baby, and we live very different lives. She contacted me recently, and I was happy about it because we shared a lot, and she really knows me. I'd hoped that I could have her in my life again as a close friend in some way, but that's impossible. The last time we spoke, we got into the kind of nasty argument that made me realize that as sad as it is, we can never be friends. Which means that I don't care about protecting her memories of us anymore. So, I had a chick in every city, and things could not have been better. They would literally be waiting for me at my gigs or in the hotel lobby in every single town I visited. They'd meet up with me, we'd hang out, and no one was the wiser. I'm talking beautiful chicks who just wanted to get on the Stern show. It was easier than shooting fish in a barrel. You might find this hard to believe, but I'm no ladies' man. Until my gig at Stern, it was a tremendous effort for me to get laid. But bagging broads on the road was so easy that even my friend Mike Buschetti could have done it. I was always staying at a nice hotel taken care of by the promoters, so I'd pay for a room next to mine where I'd send a girl to hang out and wait for me until my show was over. Then we'd fuck, and I'd keep her number, and every time I flew into Boston or Cleveland or wherever, I'd call her and we'd do it all again. I'd tell her the hotel and the room number I'd reserved under her name, and that was that. It was as easy as ordering room service. These chicks were the pick of the litter, too. There was one in Tempe, Arizona, that I will never forget until the day I die. She looked like a young Nicole Eggert with long blonde hair, a flat stomach, and perfect tits. I get great crowds in Tempe, too, so she'd see me kill in a sold-out theater that held about 3,000, which made it all the better because to a comedy groupie, that's an aphrodisiac. It gets them wet. It's the equivalent of a band groupie watching the show before blowing the guitar player. We had a great relationship, young Eggert and I. She'd enjoy my set, then back at the hotel, she'd tell me about her hard-knock life. I'd say, sure, I will buy your mother a new motorhome, and we'd have sex all night. Anyway, I went on that 2-week drug rampage with a chick I'd met in Boston back in the Stern days. That's where she was from, and that's where I bumped into her again. In 2002, she was a 23-year-old 10. In December 2015, she was a 36-year-old 8. She'd had 2 kids, but was still smoking hot, and was even more troubled than she used to be. She also had a thick, Southie accent, which is hilarious on a hot chick. A sexy girl can be dressed to the nines in a gown fit for the Oscars, but if she speaks Southie, no matter what she says, she sounds like she's heckling a Yankee batter from the bleachers in Fenway. When I walked into the lobby of the hotel that winter, there she was. I hadn't talked to her in years, and had no intention of doing so. Things were going well for me. My podcast was gaining listeners steadily month to month. My calendar was filled with stand-up gigs. Anthony and I were working on the third book. I was in talks with two different networks about my next one-hour comedy special. And I'd been cast on Judd Apatow's new project, Crashing, which began shooting in 3 weeks. There was no logical reason to risk any of that. But she was a hot chick with blow, and my life had been stable for too long. For the next 2 weeks, we were joined at the hip. I brought her on the road with me, and we had a grand old time fucking, ordering room service, and doing drugs. Our little traveling narcotics orgy culminated with me getting arrested in Jersey after things came apart in Pittsburgh when I got a nosebleed on stage. It was December on the East Coast, when pollen counts are non-existent, but I insisted to everyone I knew that I was suffering from allergies so bad that I'd cut the inside of my nose from blowing it too hard. I was blowing it all right. Here's what really happened. I was at the Four Seasons in New York with the sexy Southie, which is where I put her up when I was back home between gigs because I didn't want her at my apartment. We were there, we were partying, and I went to take a shower. I told her to order us some room service, which she did, and when it came, she decided to chop up some OxyContin right there on the tray. She did the smart thing and used a salt shaker to crush the pill, smashing the lower glass part to bits. She picked out the big pieces and tried to rescue the drugs, but still ended up with a pile of salt, glass shards, and oxy. She didn't snort any of it, because who would do that? But since she was high, she forgot to mention this blunder to me when I got out of the shower. If you're not into opiates, you've got to trust me when I say that after a nice hot shower, when you're wearing a fancy terry cloth bathrobe in a 5-star hotel, nothing could be better than a line of oxy. When the sexy Southie went into the bathroom to shower, I sat down, looked at the pile of drugs, and thought, wasn't that nice of her to set me up like that? After 2 weeks of abuse, my tolerance was high, so I cut a generous line and snorted it up my right nostril. When the mixture of salt, glass, and oxy tore into my mucous membranes, the white-hot pain was what I think it must be like to have a hot poker shoved somewhere it shouldn't be, like your ear or your ass. Despite the drugs in my system, it was so arresting that time stood still long enough for me to calmly think, something is very wrong here. Before my vision blurred and I started screaming, it felt as if my nose was held together by a zipper that someone had just violently unzipped. Well, now everything's happened, I thought. It was something I'd been thinking nearly every day for the past 2 weeks as the bender continued to escalate. Each time things got worse and more insane, I kept thinking, well, now everything's happened. And then something worse would happen, so I'd think, no, that wasn't it before. This is it. Now everything's happened. I had the right to make that distinction because I just snorted a line of glass and salt, which was something that had not happened before. I was even more pissed off when I remembered that we were in the Four Seasons. That salt shaker probably cost me $82. I'm not judging, but the sexy Southie wasn't exactly Stephen Hawking. Do I need to point this out? Who grabs a glass salt shaker to break up a pill? There were plates, silverware, bottles of booze, hotel card keys, her phone. So many sturdier options. It was the Four Seasons. She could have called the concierge and have someone come up to crush the pill for her. I'm sure it wouldn't have been the first time. I ran into the bathroom yelling at the top of my lungs, half blind with pain.
"Audie, what's the matter? You're bleeding," she said.
"Oh, you don't say," I screamed. "I know I'm fucking bleeding. What the hell was that?"
"Oh, Audie, I'm sorry. I broke the shaker crushing up the pill. I meant to tell you."
"God
damn it, my nose is now high in sodium, thank you very much. Don't you know that I have high blood pressure?
This happened precisely 1 week before my first day on set with Judd Apatow. I'd gambled, I'd lost, and I was fucked. I didn't have time to have a top surgeon clear the glass out of my nose. I had 2 gigs that week, one of them the next night. I washed out the blood and glass as best I could and did drugs up the other nostril to kill the pain. That worked a bit, but my nose was such a mess that I had to take Oxy the old-fashioned way, which is a lot less fun. My nose swelled up immediately, and I looked like I'd been in a fight because over the next few days I developed a shiner under my right eye. By the time I got to Pittsburgh the next night, I still looked okay, by which I mean my usual level of disheveled, which hovers just above homeless. My entire forehead sinus area on the right side felt like it had been smashed with a hammer. But I was highly medicated, so I managed to keep it together and get on stage. Everything was fine until my nose started bleeding profusely in front of a sold-out club full of 1,000 people. Whatever nerve endings I had left in my nose had been shredded by that glass line, so I didn't even feel it until the blood started dripping so thickly that it ran down my shirt and onto my hands. I wiped my face on my sleeve, which made things worse, tried to ignore it all, and continued my act.
"Artie, your nose is bleeding," said a voice to my right. A kid who worked for the club had come on stage with a towel. That's how bad it was. "Here, Artie, take this." When a guy comes on stage in front of 1,000 people to give you a towel because you're unaware that your nose is bleeding so heavily that it's grossing out the audience, I'd say it's time to take a look in the mirror.
"Oh, is it?" I asked.
"Thanks, man. Allergies." I watched the towel turn red as I tried to stop the flow. Then I turned to the audience and said, "Well, guys, now everything's happened." At least that's what I thought. But no, everything hadn't happened yet. The nosebleed was my cue that the jig was up, however. I'd hit a wall with this little party, and I was done. I knew what I had to do. Get rid of the sexy Southie, start weaning myself off the opiates, and get back to normal. I finished my set, went directly to an AA meeting, and started pumping the brakes on my latest slide into the abyss. My nose would not stop bleeding, however, so after the meeting I went to the emergency room, where some intern did a hatchet job on whatever was left of the cartilage in my septum. I told the girl from Boston that if I ever saw her again, I'd take out a restraining order against her, and said that none of this was her fault, but that I was weak and couldn't be anywhere near her. I reminded her that she had 2 kids to take care of at home and told her not to ask me for money or anything ever again. "It's not just the blow and the opiates," I said. "It's you and me. I can't keep doing any of this." And so we said goodbye. 1 week later, I was on set with the greatest comedy producer of this generation. After the invasive surgery, I looked like Jerry Cooney after 13 rounds with Larry Holmes, lopsided and swollen with a black eye. The makeup girls worked miracles, but they couldn't keep my nose from bleeding during every take for the first 2 days of shooting. Let's just say that no one bought my allergies excuse. Quite a return to scripted television. I had to be constantly cleaned up and blotted, but all things considered, I killed in my scenes, and Judd was happy with my performance. I don't think there is a more understanding, collaborative, and inventive film and television creator working today. Instead of seeing a negative, Judd turned it into a positive and wrote a nosebleed into the show. It ultimately didn't make the final cut, but we shot some scenes where we let my nose bleed and made it into a running joke. No pun intended. I saw a better doctor while we were shooting, and he operated on me but told me from the start that the damage had been done. The first guy had hacked out a lot of cartilage and left behind a lot of scar tissue. My nose will never be the same. It is forever unzipped. To get all the glass out, the doctor basically removed whatever was left of my septum after 30 years of doing drugs.
put it this way. If I sneeze while I'm eating cake, I sneeze cake. Yesterday I laughed at lunch and half a sub sandwich flew out one side of my nose. So my nose bled on and off throughout the shoot, and I was mortified. I tried my best to be as funny as possible to make up for it, and Judd could not have been cooler. We were shooting a major-budget HBO comedy series, and he didn't even care. He was more concerned that I get help and get better. And for him, for me, and for everyone I was working with on the show, I wanted to. But everything hadn't happened yet. After the shoot wrapped, I was still weaning myself off the opiates. I knew how to do it because it wasn't my first time, so I went out and bought as much as I'd need to slowly dial things down. Then I got arrested with that stash in New Jersey, driving home, just a few miles from my house. I was cuffed and stuffed, my car was impounded, and I spent a cold February night in jail. I have a lot of fans in law enforcement, especially in North Jersey, but that didn't help me this time. I was busted and booked by a woman cop who was clearly campaigning for Rookie of the Year. She made Sergeant Joe Friday look like Detective Frank Drebin. When we got to the precinct and she saw that every other cop there was a fan, it inspired her to be even more of a hard ass. It really ruffled her feathers when one guy went to his cruiser and came back with a copy of Too Fat to Fish. He told me that he'd kept it in the car for over a year, hoping to see me driving around town so he could pull me over and get it signed. That night he got his wish. The only upside of that female officer being by the book is that she forbade anyone from calling the press. Still, I need to take a moment to thank whoever at TMZ put a kibosh on publicizing that arrest. I will be forever grateful, and I owe them a major favor. When I was busted for a DUI a few years back, someone called them, and a guy with a camera showed up in 15 minutes. It was out to the world before I even got home, and I was less than a mile from my beach house. I'm glad they gave me a pass this time, because I was busted with a lot of drugs. It didn't look good, but to tell you the truth, I knew what I was doing. I made sure I wouldn't have to go out and get more. I planned for one trip to the dealer and bought enough to have a little bit more fun, and then taper off and be done with it again. But life threw me a curveball. I got arrested, and in the end, I was so mad at myself for fucking things up that when I got out of jail, I didn't bother getting anything to ease the withdrawals. I did them cold turkey. That's never a good time, but if you've read my second book, Crash and Burn, you know that I've been through worse. Before that, though, I spent the night in a jail cell with a very heavy-set African-American gentleman who was straight out of Central Casting. He was Hispanic, actually, as I recall. He said he was three-quarters Puerto Rican, one-quarter black. He had straight hair, or as Chris Rock would say, good hair, and weighed about 350 pounds. This was a county jail, so the cell was small, and we had bunk beds. And by law, I had to stay there until 9 o'clock the next morning. I'd made my one phone call to my producer and lifeline, Dan Filato, to tell him what had happened and when to pick me up. To tell you the truth, I was relieved because the three-week whirlwind was over. I was exhausted and coming down, so even in such tight quarters, I looked forward to getting some sleep. I tried to put the repercussions of the arrest out of my mind. Most likely I'd be fired from Crashing. Hell, they still had time to recut things and eliminate my character from the show altogether. That didn't happen, but it was all I could think of sitting there that night. I don't know what it's all about. I guess I just have that thing. I feel like someone is watching over me because somehow I ended up tiptoeing through the raindrops again. Around 4 a.m., I woke up, not uncomfortable, but aware of something not being where it should be. The only way to describe it is that there was a presence, and it was close to me. I was lying on my back on the lower bunk, and as I slowly regained consciousness, I realized that something warm and large was lying against my head. It was clammy, too, just a bit too moist. If you haven't had the pleasure of spending a night in a county jail cell, here's what it's like. They're fucking small, for one thing, with enough room for a bunk bed, a tiny sink, a toilet, and nothing else. At most, a toilet is 2 feet from the bed, which means that you and your cellmate shit in front of each other because there's no place to hide. When I opened my eyes, I realized that my cellmate was shitting. Actually, that's not quite right. He wasn't shitting at that moment, but he had been shitting. He was still sitting on the toilet, pants down, but was now sleeping. His body had relaxed, so his naked leg had drifted and was flat against my head. He was also snoring and had been asleep some time because a layer of sweat had glued his leg to my forehead. "Hey, man, what the fuck?" I said. Before I could pull my head away, he grumbled, groaned, kind of farted, and then, plop, took another shit. It was a knee-jerk reaction, like I'd startled him and literally scared the shit out of him. The worst part about it was that his knee was still against my head, so I felt it happen. It vibrated my face, because it wasn't a smooth exit. It sounded like a chainsaw cutting through a log. It was the most awkward and oddly intimate moment I've ever shared with another human being. "Dude," I said, "your knee is on my head." He turned, looked at me, and said, "Oh, my bad." Then he peeled his knee from my forehead, and it made a squelchy noise. Thank God the guy had a sense of humor, because I couldn't contain myself. "My bad?" I said. "Really? My bad? Are you kidding me? My bad is what you say when your kid's wiffle ball accidentally hits my car. When your knee is resting on me in a jail cell while you shit and I feel the release through my face, it ain't my bad. It's, oh my God, we need immediate counseling."
"You're right, man," he said, chuckling. "That was fucked up."
"We should wake up the desk sergeant and tell him what happened. At least he'll get a good fucking laugh. It ain't my bad, dude."
"No, man, you're right. It ain't my bad."
As I rolled over to go back to sleep, I knew one thing for sure. This event reset the bar. As exhaustion washed over me and I began to drift off, I found solace in just one thing. Well, that was it, I thought. No doubt about it. Now, everything's happened. Chapter 14. Hollywood Wigs, Valley Head. In 1997, I was in Canada with Norm MacDonald shooting Dirty Work, and Adam Sandler came on set for one day to do his cameo as Satan. One of our producers on the film was Robert Simmons, who was a very famous and very successful Hollywood figure. He's also Lorne Michaels' arch-nemesis because he's taken many SNL cast members that Lorne hadn't scooped up for film projects and made them into movie stars, most notably Steve Martin and Adam Sandler. By then, he'd gotten Sandler well on his way with Airheads, Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison, and the film they'd just wrapped, The Wedding Singer. That movie would push Adam into the stratosphere, but that day on set with us, just back from shooting in Hawaii, he was so frustrated with it. "Guys, whatever you do, never do a movie with a wig," he said. "Really? Oh my God, man, worst thing you could ever do. It's like having a stuffed animal on your head every day. It's hot, it's itchy, and underneath it your hair is plastered down with glue." The next movie I did was Lost and Found, playing David Spade's loser sidekick, and when they placed the wig on my head every morning, I thought of Sandler. What he hadn't mentioned was that when you have a wig, it comes with a whole team whose job it is to look after the thing. There was the wig expert who fitted the wig before shooting, and her staff of assistants who were on set every day. There were more people on the payroll to handle my wig than there would have been to handle live animals. My wig fitter was Renee of Burbank, the most famous wig lady in the business. She had about 42 cats, had been living in the same house for probably 42 years, and when she measured my head, she exclaimed, "Oh, you've got the same head as Chucky." "Chucky who?" I asked. "Chucky the doll?"
The doll who kills people?
No, I'm talking about my dear friend Charlton Heston. All of his friends call him Chucky, you know.
Oh, okay. Does the NRA call him Chucky?
What was that, dear?
Oh, nothing. The wig feels great. That wig, by the way, cost $6,000 and had an insurance policy. After they put it on me in the morning, a harem of 6 cute girl technicians spent the day following me around, making sure it looked the same in every shot. They were there the day I accidentally dunked it into some gravy at lunch, which they handled with a smile, and they paid so much attention to me that I felt special. That lasted until the second we were done, when they'd ripped the wig off my head as gently as a pit crew changing tires at a NASCAR race. Once they had the wig in their possession, they couldn't have cared less if I lived or died. But there was one woman on the makeup crew that I'll never forget, because, quite frankly, she looked like me. To quote Woody Allen in Broadway Danny Rose, she looked like something you'd find in a live bait shop. She was affectionate toward me, though, even when the wig was off, because she knew how uncomfortable that thing was. Every day after they removed it, she'd wash my hair with warm water, and she massaged my scalp so tenderly that it was a sensual experience. I'm telling you, every day as this female ogre rinsed my hair, I almost came. It was a nice long rinse, too, because it took quite a bit of glue to keep my hair matted down with the spirit gum Sandler had mentioned. The reason my character wore a wig, by the way, and this is a joke that Spade and I both missed, was that I was supposed to be like Jennifer Jason Leigh in Single White Female, copying Spade's haircut since I wanted to be like him so badly. The critics saw something else altogether because, with the wig on, I looked a lot like Chris Farley, since all fat white guys look the same. Chris had just died, and critics accused Spade of trying to replace him. This point was made in most reviews of the film, none of which were favorable, and Spade couldn't believe it. He was really hurt that anyone would think that of him. That movie Lost and Found, and this is saying a lot, is the worst thing I've ever done. There are funny moments, because David Spade is hilarious, but everything else was ill-conceived. For example, his co-star and love interest was Sophie Marceau. I saw her every morning as we got our hair and makeup done, and I realized something that until then I thought was impossible. She and I are both considered human beings. But that can't be true, because seeing us side by side, no one would take us for the same species. At 6 a.m., just out of bed, she was so stunningly beautiful that I couldn't help but stare. Then I'd catch a glimpse of myself and feel bad for the makeup artist who'd drawn the short straw. Now, in real life, Spade was a multimillionaire, a famous comedian, and dated beautiful women. He and Sophie were co-stars, and he hit on her quite a bit, but it went nowhere because she repeatedly turned him down. In the movie, however, Spade, still looking like Spade, plays a broke guy trying to launch a restaurant who gets her without even trying. That is why the movie bombed, in my opinion. It was billed as a comedy, but the plot was closer to science fiction. I texted this theory to Spade once and then typed LOL to let him know I was kidding. A moment later, he texted back, "Don't tell me when to laugh. I'm not some cheerleader you're asking to prom. I'll tell you when something's funny." Come to think of it, my life is basically a misconceived Hollywood film. It's not as bad as Lost and Found. It's a different kind of bad. It's the kind of movie that should end but keeps going. I have enjoyed many picture-perfect moments that should have been my Hollywood ending, but since this is my life, the movie continued when the credits should have rolled, and instead, in the last act, everything turned to shit. If my life's movie was supposed to be a romantic comedy, for example, it would end with me kissing the love of my life somewhere perfect, like the Eiffel Tower, which is when it should fade to black, but instead, you'd then see me throw up on her because I'm on heroin. Cut to her moving out of my apartment with a black eye that she'd received from getting hit by chunks of my puke. That's my biopic, because in real life, things keep going.
and that's what inevitably happens when it comes to me. I've had a few perfect moments, when I wish the credits would have rolled and the film had ended. One that really stands out is the time I got a blowjob from a porn star on the beach in front of the Delano Hotel in Miami at 5 a.m. It was February, when Florida has perfect breezy weather. I can't say who the porn star was, but I can say that she was once on Stern, so we knew each other, and she wanted to get back on to promote something. This happened when I went missing, which is something Stern fans will remember. I checked myself out of rehab and a few days later called in to the Stern show from that hotel in Miami. What I didn't mention that morning was what had happened the night before. When I walked into the Delano bar, she screamed my name at the top of her lungs. She was entertaining some guys who were fawning over her, but they were Stern fans, so when they saw me, they really lit up. They started quoting stories I'd told on the air and jokes from my stand-up special. A few other people recognized me, too, and I could tell that she got wet every time it happened. I had money on me, so I was buying people drinks, and she loved that. I told her to look me up on CelebrityNetWorth.com because they say I'm worth way more than I am. As I've mentioned, that site lists what I should have, which back then was even more, about $14 million. My salaries are public knowledge, so if you add them up, I should be worth $14 million. But what's not public knowledge is how much Bobo collected for me when I missed the over and under on the Holy Cross Ramapo game in 2006. Nobody at CelebrityNetWorth.com factored that in, or who I bet to win the 2007 NCAA basketball tournament, or how Virginia Tech did in the 2008 tournament. They really should have fact-checked with Bobo when he was still with us. I would have been happy to give them his number.
"What did you say Artie is supposed to be worth?" he'd ask. "14 mil?" "Hold on. Me and my sons will do the math for you so you get this right. You didn't factor in that Villanova versus Georgetown game, I guess, because you're off by a little bit. According to our figures, he's worth about 80 grand. Well, I've got you on the phone. Would you like to know my net worth for your website?"
"I'm worth about 18 million. $13,920,000 of which is Artie's. Anyway, I was talking to this beautiful porn star, and I'm no good with women, but by that point it was teed up. She was drinking, and she'd given me some sort of pill, just shot me this sexy look and laid it on my tongue, then laid one on hers. My God, that was great. Then we flowed onto the beach, and since I didn't have a rubber, she wouldn't fuck me, but that was even better. Why would I care about fucking her with a rubber when I could come in her mouth without one? Plus, this was a blowjob from a porn star, a true professional. It was perfect and efficient, like Jiffy Lube changing the oil in your car with her as the one-woman pit crew. What's the problem here, sir? Oh, an erect cock? Let me handle this. Bap! There you go, you're all set. This one's on the house. Just mention my website on the air." She got her money's worth, too. That blowjob was so good that I mentioned her website about 8 million times. I'd work it in constantly. Howard was fine with it because I told him that if he heard me mention a chick's website on the air, he had to go with it because I only did that because I'd gotten a blowjob. After it was over, the sun was starting to come up, and she snuggled up next to me. And I couldn't believe how soft her skin was. She was a young, hot, modern porn star. Nothing like the ones I grew up on. Every 70s porn star looked like Captain Lou Albano. I used to wonder who was jerking off to that, because sometimes it was hard to tell Ron Jeremy from the chick he was fucking, since they were equally hairy. My point is, that's where my film should have ended. No sequel, no bloopers, no alternate endings, just that. I should have gone from that beach into the afterlife. Preferably in a painless manner. Up there, I'd see my dad, who would tell me, "Dude, you came in here perfectly," and I'd float around on a cloud getting high fives forever. The best part was that it took place on the beach. I could go up to my room and didn't have to invite her up. I'd come, so the only thing I invited up that night was a cheeseburger. I was making money, I was on Stern, I had the next week off, and there I was lying on the beach after a blowjob. But no, my life continued, as it always does, and that's the problem. Daylight arrived and she left to return to her life of fucking men she likes to fuck, who, unfortunately for her, couldn't get her on the biggest radio show in the world, and I went off and continued to be me. I did my disappearing act from the Stern show for 8 days and really screwed things up, but I left rehab and, let me tell you, the one thing I knew for sure was that I wasn't in any hurry to return. What sounds like more fun? Group therapy or being Tommy Lee for a night? Sorry, Doc. I'm gonna have to skip group today. Actually, I'm skipping tomorrow, too. No, actually, I'm wrong. I'm skipping forever. Chapter 15 Where Heroes Dare. I remember being on a USO plane with Nick DiPaolo, heading to Afghanistan to entertain our troops and wondering how we were going to sleep because USO planes aren't exactly Emirates. They're decommissioned B-1 bombers, bare-bones military transport. The seats recline, but not a lot, and I hate flying. Nick had brought one Ambien and slept like a baby for 12 hours. I hated him. I sat there watching him sleep and counted the ways I hated him. He didn't even take the whole thing. Before he knocked off, he gave me half of it, thinking he was doing me a favor. With my tolerance, I'm lucky if half an Ambien puts the big toe on my right foot to sleep. I ended up with a sore back and a headache, and for 12 hours I sat there wanting to strangle Nick to death in his sleep. "What is he, an 11-year-old Girl Scout?" I mumbled to myself. Half an Ambien, and he's snoring like Rumpelstiltskin. But I forgot all about that the moment we landed, because I had been looking forward to giving back to my fans in the U.S. military for a while. I'd sacrificed most of my vacation time from Stern to do the 10-day trip, which meant a lot, because being allergic to mornings, nothing meant more to me than time off when I was on Stern. I'd invited Nick, Dave Attell, and Jim Florentine, all great comics. At the last minute, I added Gary Delabate as our MC. I met so many brave, dedicated, smart, and thoughtful soldiers, people who had families and loved ones at home, who treated what would scare most of us to death as nothing more than their day job. The training, the mental focus, the stamina it takes for them to keep their wits about them while they look out for each other, and, by extension, every single U.S. citizen, is truly awe-inspiring to me. What I also realized after 1 hour of being on the ground was that the brave men and women of the U.S. military are the greatest risk-takers I've ever met. Talk about life in the fast lane. They put theirs on the line, going all in every single day that they serve. To do that, you need faith. Someone like me has faith in the peace I experience from chaos and the sense of calm I get from the unpredictable. Diehard gamblers have faith in luck, their instincts, or their skill at cards. The military personnel I met have faith, too. They put blind faith in the orders handed down by the commander-in-chief, no matter what they are. If the president tells them to do something, they do it. They question nothing. They simply go out and do. A lot of Hollywood liberals are offended by people like that, but who do you want in your military? People like Ryan Seacrest's assistant? You need warriors in an army, and warriors don't question orders. Each of us had a personal bodyguard for the entire trip, because a few of the bases on the tour were in hostile territory. My bodyguard was a black Marine from Brooklyn who spoke real ghetto and made fat jokes nonstop. I had to laugh at those, mostly fake laugh, because his job was to protect me, and I figured he'd do a better job if I seemed to like his jokes. At one point, we were under mortar attack, and I asked him what would happen if I were to be hit by a mortar. "Aw, man, don't worry about that at all," he said. "If one of those motherfucking things hits you, you're just gonna be dust. You'll disintegrate. You won't feel shit, so why worry about it?
Really?
Yeah, really. You get hit with a mortar, you're gonna be dust. You, of all people, you're gonna be a lot of dust. And me? I'll have to clean up that dust.